winner of a New York State Emmy for Best Political Program. This is New York Now.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to New York Now. I'm Matt Ryan. With a budget deadline of Friday this week, Andrew Cuomo and legislative leaders went back and forth negotiating some of the trickier parts of the state's spending plan. Where are we now? My partner from the Times Union, Casey Seiler, tries to answer that question at today's Reporters Roundtable.
All right. Well, thanks, Matt. For what we know about the budget at this point, I'm happy to be joined at the Reporters Roundtable by Matt Hamilton from my paper, The Times Union, and Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio. All right. Ground rules. We're talking a little bit after 9 o'clock on Friday morning. There was a blow up in budget negotiations. They happen periodically on Thursday. What does it appear are the issues that are still causing friction between Governor Cuomo and legislative leaders?
Well, I would just comment before we even get to that, that isn't it the adage that the budget has to blow up three times?
Yeah.
And if we're only on number one, that
we've
doesn't
got a, we got a ways to go.
Unless they have some very quick fights and make up during the day. But yeah, there are a number of outstanding issues. One of them is the so-called raise the age, treating 16 and 17-year-olds as children, not adults, in state prison. They're thinking about making some kind of special youth court for the more, if there's more serious offenses that the teenagers are accused of. And some people are not, don't really want to do that. They would rather just, you know, put them in family court, put them in juvenile detention centers if they're convicted. And why start this like whole like kind of mini justice system, which we don't have many details on, right? But it sounds complicated to me.
We could spend the whole segment talking about raise the age.
We're not going to.
I know. I mean, some of the other issues include the list of crimes. And I mean, it seems like, based on conversations, that they've gone through like crime by crime. Well, would this be considered you would be charged as an adult? Would you be charged as a minor under this crime? So that is, I mean, it's a messy subject. It's a difficult subject to get through. It's very complex. So there's that, and then there's education aid has also emerged as
always
this.
Always
something. The governor's proposed a $1 billion increase over funding from last year. The legislature always, you know, historically always says, we would like more than that, please. And so there's that. Then we could spend another hour talking about foundation aid, you know, this sense of, like, what does it take base level to actually educate a single child in every school district?
Mm-hmm. And the governor essentially feels like that's constraining him right now. And he's been trying to blow that up for months in one form or another.
He's been trying to make foundation aid, essentially, that formula kind of go away. It's been with us now for about 10 years.
But getting lots of pushback from teachers, unions, school boards, the whole education community, plus lots of lawmakers who, you know, happen to have schools in their districts. So he hasn't really gotten that far with that. There's also the argument over charter schools, which is the perennial argument. Republicans, the Independent Democratic Conference, they want to raise the cap, allow more charter schools to operate. Mostly Assembly Democrats and Senate Democrats as well don't want that to happen.
Well, and they want to make sure that charter schools also have a proper level of state funding. I mean, Senate Majority Leader John Flanagan has said and said again this week that charter schools are public schools. I mean, we need to treat them as we do all other schools. You know, we shouldn't be saying that these children are different than these children.
And it's an interesting issue because there are Democrats, including a lot of inner city Democrats, who have charter schools in their districts that they very much want to support. So it doesn't fall on strict party lines. On Monday and Tuesday, Governor Cuomo came out and said something surprising for this late in the budget negotiation, which was, boy, with all this uncertainty about how much federal support we can count on, considering the tumult in Washington, D.C., maybe we're really going to need a cautious budget and maybe just an extender budget that essentially just pushes forward current levels of spending.
Which, honestly, I think makes a lot of sense given the federal climate. Why don't they just extend the budget for another 6 months and see what happens? It would certainly tamp down spending. The only problem is lawmakers won't be paid.
If it was an actual extender as opposed to just kind of an extension.
Yeah, because there was
spending.
A law made when they had years of late budgets essentially to punish lawmakers for having a late budget. Now that's going to catch up with them because they're not going to want to do that. Why should they be punished? They're here working. But it does make sense because we really don't know. And it just seems like there is a lot of bad news coming down. And they, you know, they really shouldn't increase a lot of spending in the budget.
I mean, the counterpoint to that is, isn't there always some level of federal uncertainty? I mean, if the federal budget process isn't done until the fall every mm-hmm. year, and we have a springtime mm-hmm. budget mm-hmm. process, I mean, of course, the difference is that we now have a fully Republican Congress mm-hmm. and a Republican White House, and they, you know, the president's so-called skinny budget.
Yeah. was pretty brutal to New York.
Yeah. Right.
They
and
don't
so,
like New York, the most of the Republicans in Congress, so you can count on them really trying to cut things.
Right. And so I guess we've kind of known that there was this federal uncertainty cool. coming into this, but then we saw the health care bill that ultimately met its demise, mm-hmm. but New York faced, according to the Cuomo administration, massive cuts in terms of Medicaid spending, which is a huge portion of the budget. And then you have the president's proposed budget that, again, starts to cut federal funding and a lot of aid to New York. And so there is a lot of uncertainty, but just passing this extender, the other thing to keep in mind is you can't fund new programs. And so all this new policy that you're talking about in the budget, let's take Raise the Age, for example. Mm-hmm. If you have to fund some sort
youth
of new court,
court if you have
system,
to construct
right,
youth courts.
Or if you have to fund, you have to start shipping kids out of county jails to some other separate facility because mm-hmm. that's where they need to be housed because they're minors. How are you going to fund that? Is it going to be an unfunded mandate on counties if you pass that policy with an extender budget?
And
I mean,
also,
what happens?
You also make a good point. They did know this in January. So the governor could have said in January, look, we're going to be really cautious. We're going to see what happens. Maybe there'll be some new programs later in the year. And so, yeah, why is he suddenly doing this? I think it was actually maybe Tuesday or Wednesday, but it was very close to the end.
It was Q&A at the State Museum on Tuesday.
Yeah,
one
so
thing
was
he was asked
close.
About is, hey, would this cautious budget still have room for your $160 million free tuition plan?
Yeah,
and the
I
governor said,
that,
well,
a
that's
fact,
a
oh,
very
yes,
good question, Karen. And he said, well, that's just a moderate, you
yeah,
know,
he's like,
expense.
Oh, it's just modest spending. We could do that, but not any of those other things that the lawmakers want.
Matt mentioned the demise of the AHCA, right. the American Healthcare mm-hmm. Act, the GOP, what was alternately known as Trump Care, which failed. There were a lot of lawmakers who kind of put themselves out there to support it. And that included John Faso mm-hmm. from right around here, Hudson Valley and the Capital Region. Is he likely to face blowback either for the support or for the amendment that he and Chris Collins introduced, which would have obligated New York to pick up the full county share of Medicaid that's currently borne largely by local property taxpayers?
I mean, yes, we're already seeing that Democrats, the folks that who traditionally are better at, the progressive Democrats who are traditionally better at getting their message out, organizing around these things, holding protests, that mm-hmm. kind of thing, they already are very angry that he said, I will vote for this. Ultimately, he did not have to vote from the floor on it, though he did vote to move it out mm-hmm. of a committee.
And he had to state his position.
Right.
Yeah.
So you are seeing some blowback from that. But I think the thing to keep in mind moving forward is that this is a big deal. Healthcare is a big deal, and there are a lot of people who were scared and continue to be scared about what the future of their insurance coverage is. But we have a year and three quarters until the next election, and there is a lot that can happen between now and then. And so while people are very angry about this now, it's not like, let's see what else happens that perhaps takes precedent over that or can be looped into this and add to a broader anger. I mean, I think that's just the thing to keep in mind moving forward is that November 2018 is a long way away from
and look
right
how
now.
Much has happened in the last week.
Exactly.
I still think that Faso's going to have a hard time because he's a first-term congressman. Somebody like Chris Collins in Western New York has a base. Elise Stefanik, who represents the North Country, she's been there a while. And this is like the first thing
Elise
that Faso's
Stefanik, by the
done.
Way, who never
yes, she,
took a position
yeah,
on
she was
the AHCA.
Clever about that. She managed never to get into the fray, and it turns out that she doesn't have to yet. But you're right. I mean, I don't think that the repeal of Obamacare is done, even though President Trump said that a week ago. I think it's going to come back in some form. And who knows? It may come back in the fall of 2018, which would be really hard for all of these congresspeople running for re-election.
And very quickly, on Thursday, the governor and a bunch of Democratic members of Congress, Elliot Engel, Paul Tonko from up around here, said that the congressmen were going to introduce a bill that would essentially give New York the $2.3 billion mm-hmm. that it would have been on the hook for mm-hmm. if the Faso-Collins amendment went through.
Yeah.
What has a better chance of happening? me riding out of the studio on a unicorn or this bill passing?
Well, I think the unicorn is waiting outside to take it away. But I guess they felt like they had to do some kind of counterproposal because they were really caught flat by that last week. So they can say, no, well, we have an idea, too, that you know the feds will pay for this.
All right. Well, that's where we're going to have to end it. Thanks a lot. Good luck as the budget winds down, maybe or maybe not, too. Matt Hamilton from the Times Union and Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio. And now we'll kick it back to Matt at the desk.
All right, thanks, Casey. Our poll question asks, how important is an on-time state budget? Check out our choices online at nynow.org and let us know. Last time we posed this question, do you support the American Healthcare Act proposed by the Republican Congress? And 70% said no. Charles in Manhattan watching on WNET said, it's a disgrace. All Americans have a right to good, affordable health care. Michael on the northern shore of Long Island watching on WLIW told us, it's not reassuring that it went down to defeat because powerful Republican conservatives thought it was not harsh enough. John in Rochester watching on WXXI-TV voted yes. It can be improved, and I feel that is where the effort should go, especially if it gets Republicans to work with Democrats again. And finally, Diane in Menands said, I think President Trump and Congress should focus their energy on improving the health care law rather than repeal and replace. We appreciate all the votes and opinions. Again, to vote on this week's poll, go to nynow.org. There you will find all of our past programs, plus links to us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where our handle is at nynow_PBS. Plus, you'll find a link to the Capital Confidential blog run by Casey and his staff. That can also be found at timesunion.com. All right, we're going to send it back to Casey Seiler once more. This time, he is with the new president of the Rockefeller Institute of Government, Jim Mylotras.
Well, timing is everything in politics and think tank event planning. And so it was on Friday, March 24th, that SUNY's Rockefeller Institute of Government held a morning seminar on what a number of healthcare leaders could foresee about the fate of the Federal Affordable Healthcare Act, aka Obamacare. Of course, a few hours later, Americans learned that the proposed Republican replacement, the American Healthcare Act, had been pulled from the floor of the House of Representatives for lack of votes. Here to talk about what emerged from the gathering and much more is Jim Mylotras, the man recently appointed as president of the Rockefeller Institute after serving for many years as a top aide to Governor Andrew Cuomo. Welcome. Great to see you.
Nice to be here, Casey.
So I would imagine there was no way to predict that the vote on the American Healthcare Act was going to fall on the same day as the Rockefeller Institute's gathering.
I knew it was going to happen that day. No, actually, we knew we were going to be in the middle of the debate.
Yeah.
And it was literally when we started the program, high noon for healthcare, as we call that, as we kicked off the event. Our event started 2 hours before they thought about doing the vote or calling the vote. So, yeah, the timing was perfect, at least to have this discussion. But it's going to be an ongoing discussion, we think, for some time.
So if you could summarize kind of the panoply of anxiety that was expressed by many of the healthcare leaders. You had hospital folks there. You had advocates for the poor and underinsured there as well as representatives, of course, of the health insurance industry. I mean, how would you summarize the different types of nervousness that they're feeling as the federal government, even today, you know, Republicans are saying, no, we're going to bring it up again, ways to repeal and replace Obamacare?
There was a lot of anxiety and questions that were raised. The advocates particularly were concerned about the Medicaid program. That was something, when you're talking about Obamacare, not many people talk about. And the federal congressional, which they're calling Trump Care or whatever you'd like to call it, did a dramatic change to the Medicaid program for states. So that was a big concern for many advocacy groups, hospitals. The insurers and business community, who are sometimes on the opposite side of the advocacy community, they raise a lot of questions about uncertainty. And uncertainty in the business community is worse than knowing what you have. Mm-hmm. And they rather see changes and tweaks to a program that they know exists currently in the ACA or what we call Obamacare. But this great uncertainty was difficult for health insurance providers to put together their actuarial programs and what the premiums will be. The business community, small businesses, medium businesses, large businesses, how do you plan in the future to meet your bottom line in some level? So there was great
fear on the Medicaid program, and particularly on the uncertainty of how some of the insurance components or the exchanges from state to states will be affected.
Just last month in February, the Rockefeller Institute and the Brookings Institute put out a report that looks specifically at the question of how states that opted for the Medicaid expansion under the ACA are doing, how the exchanges are doing, looking at kind of the range of experiences that they've had. The states were California, Michigan, Florida, North Carolina, and Texas, not New York. And looking at the problem of how competitiveness is or is not occurring in those states when the exchanges hit headwinds, especially on questions of profitability and the fact that you get essentially more sick people signing up for expanded Medicaid under the program.
You know, it's interesting. The ACA isn't perfect, right? So when we've been looking at the ACA now since its inception, since 2010, and we have a 40-state network. So we just released the 5-state report, as you mentioned. And you're right. What the ACA didn't expect in the health exchange world is more sick people are actually signing up than they actually thought were going to sign up. That has driven up costs considerably. You're seeing marked differences in different areas in the country, and even within states, competition is much more narrow in some parts, which are driving up premiums. When there's less healthcare providers in those communities, you see the prices rising on healthcare. So you're seeing variation, some of which you can then extrapolate even to New York or general principles in that case. But we're also looking at the politics of how the ACA was adopted. Those oppositional states often have had more troubles on some cases implementing the Obamacare program, the ACA, the networks, because they've just been opposed. And now it's taken a longer time to actually get it up and running. States like Michigan, which we've examined, for instance, they were doing a lot of the legwork like New York was before Obamacare even came to be. So it was much easier for them to implement this law, even though they had a Republican leadership in place. So you see great variation from community to community, from state to state.
President Donald Trump, of course, has said, he's tweeted it many times now, okay, what we're going to do is just wait for Obamacare to collapse and essentially to fill the kind of chaotic vacuum that will occur after that. Democrats will rush in and we'll be able to find kind of common cause. That sounds very much like a policy disaster.
Well, listen, we're not in the political enterprise. We're in the policy enterprise. Usually when you're doing program implementation, you don't look at maximum ways to hurt people in a program.
So that's good to know.
The loss of health care for millions of Americans potentially to drive a program out of existence to change is something generally people shy against doing. But we've been looking at different areas in the country now that have some of these similar problems. Mm-hmm. What the president has raised doing is what some communities across the nation have already tried to do, right? In Texas, they saw a lot of problems because they had more sick people signing up, for instance. But also, they were just opposed to the law. So they tried to do things to undermine the law.
To starve the baby,
as it were. To starve the baby, which actually drove up the health care cost and didn't insure as many people. So we probably don't want to see more people becoming uninsured just to prove a political point. But when fixing laws come into place, you can look at ways states have already done this to make obvious political statements.
Moving on from healthcare, the Rockefeller Institute is a unique entity. It's essentially the think tank for the SUNY system, the large, you know, public university system in New York. I mean, what are you hoping to bring to its leadership as you take over?
We have a great a cohort of established experts across the SUNY system. We're very strong in Federalist studies, fiscal policy studies, healthcare and education studies. The one thing I'd like to do, and you're seeing it now, is we want to be ahead of the curve as issues of the day of political and public policy importance are coming out or are being developed or implemented at that time, to lend objective, evidence-based policy decision-making opportunities to those policymakers themselves. So that's something that Rockefeller has been known for historically, is evidence-based policy. That's how we draw, that's been our standard for 30, 40 years now. That's not going to change. But how do we now connect those studies and those policy potential changes to stakeholders as it's actually happening in real time? on of the Affordable Health Care Act, on the changes to power plant emissions requirements from the federal government, to water quality, to education policy, which is changing dramatically. How do you present sort of fixes, solutions to those policymakers to make the decisions they make?
It, of course, is an extraordinarily, as you acknowledge, kind of politicized realm to move into. All of the issues you just mentioned are going to be the flashpoints for debates, not only moving forward, but if you look in the past as well. You mentioned healthcare, you mentioned environmental issues. The Rockefeller Institute has done great work, I think you would agree, on public pensions. What are some other areas where you think there are opportunities for research from the Institute?
Well, energy and environment, that subject matter area is changing so rapidly with global warming on the horizon, with how people deal with water quality. How do you get access to clean drinking water? We have problems in New York State. There's problems nationally. There's problems internationally because of our historic manufacturing past. How do you deal with that? What are the regulations that you adopt? How do states interact with the federal government? How do you do funding mechanisms to get more clean water infrastructure? Those are big issues of the day that Rockefeller hasn't historically been part of, but it fits into our objective, evidence-based sort of model, which we think can lend some real expertise to those subject matter areas. And then finally, one of the areas that we're really going to focus on again is within the Constitutional Convention sphere, ethics reform. What are some new ethics reform is constantly the call of the day. In New York and other places too, federal government, other states are grappling with how to best bring more of an ethical environment to their government. How can people believe in their government? We're going to get into that space very heavily, too. I brought Jeremy Creelan on, who was formerly of the Brennan Center, also worked for the administration. But he is one of the preeminent ethics people in the state, as well as we have Jerry Benjamin and others that we're going to lend their voices to some of those challenging issues of the day.
The Rockefeller Institute has been among the groups in the forefront, along with the State Bar Association, in sort of helping to lay the ground for the vote that's coming up in November on whether or not there should be a constitutional convention. Do you think time has run out or is running out to kind of do the scholarly spade work that's necessary to kind of trickle out from the academic community to the press, to the general public? I mean, I've taken part in some of those discussions, but I mean, boy, we're coming up now on what, 8 months until the vote?
It's interesting, like any issue or any, the vote, when do voters start to pay attention is the first question, right?
October.
So I think we have as much time as time allows us to have, and I think what the Rockefeller Institute's going to do is we're going to work hard on presenting issues to voters across the state until that vote is held. So if you want to pay attention now or you want to pay attention 2 days before, we're going to provide citizens the opportunity to understand what the convention is, to understand what the constitutional process is, to understand some of the problems with the current constitution as drafted and some of the good things that this state has in its constitution, and then let voters decide what they want to do with it. But we're going to run right hard, very hard to the tape, Casey. We're not going to stop until the vote's actually held.
So you are coming from serving as Governor Cuomo's state director of operations, the ultimate nuts and bolts under the hood job in the administration. I think you would probably agree.
That is true.
Did you get to keep your blizzard jacket?
I do have my blizzard jacket just in case I get called in for a volunteer opportunity.
To that point, how do you kind of defang suspicions from some quarters that you are now working for a think tank with national interests on topics that are likely to be coming down the pike as political debates, that essentially the Rockefeller Institute could become the pet think tank of Andrew Cuomo, a politician who many people say is considering pondering a run for president in 2020?
Well, I'll say this. Connecting to policymakers, whether it's the governor or legislators or local county executives, isn't a bad thing. That's what makes a think tank sort of exist, right? What separates us from an academic department is you want to be on in relevant issues, providing expertise to those people making decisions in government. But put that aside. The mission, vision statement from the Rockefeller Institute, which I have to abide by, I'm a representative of that organization, is evidence-based policymaking. And that's what we do. And we have experts who I don't control. They have their very strong opinions about what they think is right or wrong. What I'm going to help do in that space of evidence-based policymaking is allow debate to happen. And I think you've seen that in our work. Our work hasn't changed. I think people think our work is the gold standard of objective-based policymaking. But debate is good. The former chancellor of SUNY, Bruce Johnstone, and I, for instance, just had a public discourse on college access and affordability through the Excelsior Scholarship Program. Those debates are going to be enhanced now under my leadership at Rockefeller Institute. I want debate to happen. It's not one version of the world or the other, and I think that actually helps drive the public discourse, so you're going to see more of that. But time will tell, right? If people think the proof is in the pudding. What we produce is how you judge us by, and you'll judge us by our work, and you'll have to tell me, 6 months down the road if you think we've become something different than what we've been.
You hold a PhD in public policy from UAlbany, correct?
That's correct.
Are people now calling you Dr. Malatris?
They are calling me Dr. Malatris. This is a welcomed change. You call a lot of things in politics. It's usually not doctor, though.
Good point. All right. Well, Dr. Jim Malatris, good to have you in. I hope we have you again soon.
Nice to be here. Thanks a lot.
I arrived there as a 21-year-old, fresh out of college punk kid, and ran up to the front of the prison, and there was a couple of troopers there with a shotgun. I said, "I'm Rich Funky from Wham Radio. Let me in." They said, "Let you in. We're not going in there. Get across the street with everybody else."
The guest on our latest podcast is Rochester area State Senator Rich Funky. We talk politics, the media, and about his job as a broadcast journalist that spanned four decades, including the time he was the first reporter to arrive at the scene of the Attica prison riots. Check it out on nynow.org or on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And that's all the time we have for this week. For Casey Seiler and everyone here at New York Now, I'm Matt Ryan. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time right here on your local PBS station.